Hey there, it's Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli, and I want to chat with you about a key ingredient for a fabulous date night, feeling sexy. And come on, let's be real. What you wear plays a big part in how you rock that confidence. That's why I'm thrilled to introduce you to Quince. Quince brings you premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts starting at just $30, along with washable silk tops, 40-karat gold jewelry, and more. And guess what? All of their goodies are priced 50 to 80% lower than similar brands. By teaming up directly with top factories, Quince skipped the middleman and hands us the saving. Plus, they stick to factories with safe, ethical practices and top-notch fabrics and finishes. How awesome is that? Picking from Quince's website was tough, because they have a ton of fabulous choices. I ended up going for their 100% washable silk sleep dress in champagne. And let me tell you, my husband was floored. He's convinced whoever rocks this is in for a blast. I'm going to record some content on that dress so you can see how fabulous is that dress. Elevate your date night style with Quince. Pop over to quince.com/sexology for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/sexology to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/sexology.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli.
Hello, and welcome to episode 83 of Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Mo'oli. Today, we're going to talk about the kind of incorporating sexual excitement, sexual joy back in your life if you're recovering from sexual addiction. I see a kind of similar pattern in my clients that are kind of been diagnosed with sexual addiction, similar pattern with individuals who are struggling with quote unquote what's known as food addiction, or what I call it, binge eating disorder, that people feel only if I don't enjoy these kind of foods that I enjoyed, only if I don't have sex the way I used to have sex and don't do things that was exciting for me, I'll be okay. And at times, that might be necessary for early stages of recovery, but I don't want people to have, at least for my clients, to have a small lives and they be kind of fearful of what if I do things that are exciting and pleasurable because of the fear of relapse. Alexandra Katahakis is a founder and clinical director of the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles, senior fellow at the Meadows, and faculty for the International Institute of Trauma and Addiction Professionals. She won a number of different awards and accolades throughout her career, and she's a certified sex addiction therapist supervisor and ASAC certified sex therapist supervisor, specializing in treatment of sexual addiction and other sexual disorders. She has multiple publications, and during this interview, we talk about her newest book that I just mentioned to you guys about how to incorporate healthy sexuality back in your life after recovering from sexual addiction. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you guys that I'm doing this survey about how can I improve this podcast for you. So if you have a moment, please go to our show notes and take this brief 5-question survey so I would know what are some of the topics that you might be interested to learn more about so I can provide you with better content. Anyhow, without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Alexandra Katahakis.
Welcome back to another episode of Sexology Podcast. I am so excited and honored to have Dr. Alexandra Katahakis on our show today. Welcome to our show, Alex.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I am very excited for this conversation. I don't know if you remember or not, I was sharing with our listeners that the first exposure I had around training about sexual addiction was at your facility when it was back in Olympic. And it was like first year of graduate school. And I was like, oh, well, this makes sense. And it wasn't until later on that I got more training on sex therapy, and I realized and I learned about this kind of conflict and misconceptions when it comes around sexual addiction recovery. So I see you are the main voice of like helping people to understand sexual addiction recovery better. So what are some of the common misconceptions that you hear that people have when it comes to intimacy after recovery?
Well, first of all, I don't think that intimacy, I assume we're saying sexuality, because I don't use the words intimacy and sexuality interchangeably. I think intimacy has to do with the emotional connection between two people, honesty, vulnerability, integrity, and sex has to do with that plus, you know, engaging the body. So I don't think that people, you know, finish their sex addiction and then get into a healthy sexuality. I don't think human beings are that linear. I think people are investigating their sexuality while they are also interested in eliminating the sexual behaviors they were engaging in that were creating problems or messes in their lives.
That's interesting. I didn't think about, usually I use the term kind of interchangeably, and it makes sense when you make the distinction.
Yeah, because I think people have a difficult time talking about sex. So couples will come to therapy and say, well, we haven't been intimate in a long time. And I think, well, what does that mean? You haven't been talking to each other? what you're saying is you haven't had sex. You haven't had intercourse. You haven't been touching each other's bodies. That's a very different conversation.
Absolutely. And I think sex is unique, like similar to food, that it's not, you know, when we're in recovery, it doesn't make sense for us long term to not being sexual. I want to use the intimate term again, not being sexual. But, and it's just like, that's one of the fear that people have. But I was just reading your book and I attended the workshop you had. And I think it was interesting that the way that you encourage people to kind of like explore their sexuality after recovery, it seems like it's kind of adding to their sex life versus kind of subtracting and kind of changing it in this way. That's just very limiting.
Well, of course, I think that's one of the mythologies or misnomers or one of the attacks that are made on the sex addiction model is that it's sex negative and that it's, you know, heavily wrapped in religiosity and shaming and, you know, heteronormative, and the list goes on and on, which is a very old construct. The book you're referring to is my new workbook, Sexual Reflections, which is a workbook for designing and celebrating a sexual health plan for individuals who identify as being in recovery from sexual addiction or sexual compulsivity or problematic sexual behaviors or out of control sexual behavior, whatever you want to call it, so that people are saying, you know, I've gotten through a point now where I've been honest with my partner if they're partnered, or if they're single, I've stopped the behaviors that are destructive and that have me out of my integrity. Because what we hear from people who identify as, quote, sex addicts is that they're doing all sorts of things against their value system, which has very little to do with morality. It's just what we value in life, how we want to see ourselves as good people. And they know that they're hurting people or doing things that are destructive or unkind. And so they want to stop doing those things, but they want to enjoy sex and sexuality in a way that's pleasurable and interesting. And so my workbook, Sexual Reflections, takes people through a process where they're really examining what they were doing, what felt bad to them, what they would like to be doing, and also maybe what they were doing that they would like to do without feeling bad about. So that's really shame reduction.
Right. And I'm kind of curious about, I know in the book you're talking about the difference between the healthy sex and addictive sex. So can you tell us a little bit about those differences?
Sure. I mean, if you really... and this is just a clinical observation, meaning this is what I've watched and seen in people over the last 20 years. And it's also been written about by Dr. Patrick Carnes. I've adapted some of his work. But, you know, addictive sex, for starters, originates from a feeling of being shameful about sexuality. So shame, sex is dirty, it's bad. it's shameful. And anytime I do it, I feel bad about myself. And healthy sex is meant to really deepen a sense of self, that just as we know what kind of foods we like or what kind of exercise we like or what kind of vacations we like, we should know what kind of sex we like. It should just be an integrated part of who we are without shame or without embarrassment about it. So that's one criteria. There are many others. I mean, addictive sex is really opportunistic. It takes advantage of other people. And healthy sex is really about being consensual and mutually respectful and honoring. So in other words, you know the person in a way that feels like it's additive to your life, not like you're just using or taking advantage of somebody. And as I was saying before, addictive sex really compromises a person's integrity or value system, whereas healthy sex reinforces your value system and makes you feel good about yourself. Also, what we know about people that identify as sex addicts is that they confuse intensity for intimacy. So it's always about, oh my God, it was so intense, or it was so passionate, or this or that. But there's not much vulnerability in that. And in healthy sex, we really encourage people to get naked emotionally, to become vulnerable, and to recognize that vulnerability is really the portal to being intimate, meaning close, super emotionally close with, you know, an open heart to another person, and that open-heartedness leads to eroticism. Sex addicts have what a colleague of mine calls a crotch attachment, as opposed to a heart attachment.
Oh, and what is that?
Well, I mean, that you're just attaching from the crotch. It's all about genitals and getting off. And it's not really about any kind of connection with the other person. And again, I don't have a morality about that. It's not right or wrong. It's just that over time, it gets tiresome and it can start to feel empty for a lot of people.
Right. And when you were talking about feeling shame around sexuality, I think, unfortunately, it's just so common that because most people I see in my practice, they're coming from a more conservative background, and they feel kind of like for them, sexuality and shame is kind of connected.
Right.
So is this a spectrum that people are organized for, like their addictive sexual behavior, or is just a line, and when they're crossed, they kind of consider as a sex addict?
I think it's probably the former. And that brings me to another point that sex addiction is often a reenactment of trauma, and it starts to really cement arousal patterns in the brain. So if somebody was sexually tampered with in any way as a child, they felt shameful about that, dirty, they knew it was wrong, they didn't tell anybody. That gets fused with their sexuality. So sex that's arousing is usually secretive or furtive or shaming. And so in healthier sexual configuration, we want people to be able to explore their sexuality and kind of rewire their sexual arousal template so it's not relegated to the same thing over and over and over again that keeps reinforcing shame and making them feel more shameful over time. So it becomes sort of like a tumbleweed. If somebody was sexually abused as a child, then they feel shameful and they keep doing that thing for decades. After a while, they don't even know where the sexual trauma was. They've now just kind of created this monstrously shameful sexuality. So we want to help people get out of that.
And I think one thing that you talk about it in the book, and you kind of explained it in the class, was about kind of like incorporating your values. Because one thing at times is challenging as adults, people's kind of erotic templates are kind of solidified. And it's just like, you know, it's hard to kind of drastically change it. And like that when you incorporate the use of values and kind of finding what is it there that's exciting and congruent with your values and how we can incorporate that versus saying that just forget about that part, that thing that was arousing completely. And from now on, you're going to have this kind of like sexual relationships.
Right. And I think that is, again, one of the misnomers about, you know, sex addiction being sex negative, that if somebody, you know, likes a certain sexual act, in their compulsive behaviors, they may still like it after their recovery. And the difference is it secretive? Is it shaming? Does it feel abusive to yourself or another person? Or can you just own it and say, you know what? I just like that particular thing. That sex act, let's say the sex act is oral sex for, you know, lack of being too creative here or offending anybody. But, you know, this is a pretty common sex act, but for some people, it may still feel a little bit racy or wrong or something like that. But if that's something that's really arousing to them and they were doing a lot of it when they were sexually compulsive, we don't want people in sexual recovery to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. Now it's about, let's talk about your shame around it and your embarrassment and the narrative you have around it and what you were told about it. And let's look at this in real time. You're an adult person. You get to have an adult sexuality independently of what your parents told you or your culture told you or perhaps even your religion told you. What's true for you? And if you enjoy it, can you enjoy it without shame? And that's really the difference. We just don't want sex to be underground and swaddled in shame so that it keeps being secretive and becomes increasingly more problematic because you have to lie or you have a secret life in order to do what you want to do.
And I like that kind of like focusing on removing the shame and kind of helping people to do things that are not necessarily destructive, but it's enjoyable because I think pleasure is everyone's like human right thing. And it's just important for us to experience pleasure. And in your book, you were talking about sexual health plan and you were talking about it's helpful for people in recovery. I was just reading and working through it. And I think it can be helpful for most people.
I agree.
Because we're just, most of us, we didn't have opportunity to kind of think about different components of sexuality. So I think it gives people hands-on tools to kind of explore those things.
I think that's true for all of my books, that they're all generalizable to sexuality. You don't have to be sexually addicted or compulsive. Mm-hmm. It just happens that that was an area of interest I had, you know, early on in my career. I was really interested in human sexuality and sexual health, but I started examining this problem of sexual addiction and I thought, wow, this is just a problem of sex on a continuum. And how do we help people, you know, who have had so much shame and abuse around their sexuality start to become sexually healthy? So you're right. The workbook Sexual Reflections is definitely generalizable to all people. Some of it might be irrelevant, but most of it will be highly relevant, I think, if people are interested in figuring out, well, who am I sexually and what do I like sexually?
And kind of like being kind of mindful of different components of sexualities, which is like a physiological component is just one part of it. And there's just so many things that plays into it.
Right. Right.
And also, you can focus on kind of helping people with creating their sexual health plan. Why do you think is that important?
Well, because I think we don't think about our sexuality the way we think about, you know, our hairstyle and our fashion and we work out and we do all these things to improve ourselves or to make ourselves feel good. But we don't really think about, well, what is my current erotic template, because this changes from decade to decade. And certainly when people are teenagers, it's a time of massive exploration and pretty much, you know, anything goes and sex seems kind of weird and freaky and eventually can feel sort of fun and exciting. And then in our 20s, you know, our arousal is so much higher just naturally, physiologically. So it's easy to get turned on for the most part for many people. But then, you know, people move into their 30s and they get more responsibility. If they start a family, their sex life really drops off. And then at 40, you're a different person altogether. And then the body changes again radically in the late 40s and 50s. And 60s and 70s, and so it goes. So I think it's important to sort of reevaluate, you know, just like we reevaluate goals for our careers or our lives, you know, what do I like sexually today? Do I even know? Wow, my body doesn't respond the way it used to. What am I going to do about that? What do I want to do about that? How do I talk to my partner about that? These are just conversations. I think the idea for sexual reflections is that it has people really reflecting on themselves and then encouraging them to start to have conversations with the people that they're having sex with.
Right. And I think specifically one of the exercise that's one of my favorites, and I can end the class, I thought was great. It was on identifying and clarifying your sexual values. And I practice from acceptance and commitment therapy, and value is such an important part of that. And I think people sometimes ask me, is this wrong that I like that? And I don't think necessarily there's a wrong or right way of doing things. It's about whether this act is congruent with your values. And it was very interesting that you have one for sexual values. So I'm kind of curious, why do you think is that important? And is our values something that changes throughout the years?
I think they do change throughout the years, but generally, you know, depending on how people are raised, our parents are very powerful forces in our lives because, you know, as you know, children's brains are extremely malleable, and we can create securely attached children or insecurely attached children, and that will then impact their psychological state over a lifetime and even their health now, we know. So for as much as many of us rebel in our teens and 20s and strike out to new lands and try all sorts of different things, eventually I think because we're so habituated and our brains are so automatic, we end up reverting back to the values we originally grew up with. And so I think while they can change and they're malleable, they generally also kind of stay within the same bandwidth. But I think we have to think about, you know, I use the word sexual values, but it's really about, you know, what's sexually arousing to you? Mm-hmm. And is what sexually arousing to you, does that align with what your personal values are? So, for example, I've had many men tell me over the years that they did all sorts of things outside of their value system when they were engaging in multiple affairs or hiring sex workers or having sex with, you know, people outside of their sexual orientation because it was all about intensity and they weren't very present. In fact, they might have been rather dissociated and they were living these double secret lives and weren't in touch with their feelings at all and in a lot of pain. And so it's not about saying that sex act was wrong. There's no wrong sex act or sexual behavior. It's about, wow, when I do that thing, I'm so far out of my integrity and so far out of my value system that I don't like myself.
Right. And that's what causes distress. And I like that, like you're kind of like shedding a light on that component. And I know you have another section that you talk about, like defining what is that, like what's your description of it? And when I do that with couples, you just realize how each person's definition is different. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is different. And that's why it's fun for couples to do together, to each person look at their values and then each person look at what their sexual values are, what turns them on, and then to compare them and to see, oh, wow, are we close to being on the same page here? Do we have different ideas and wants and needs? And then how do we have a constructive conversation to start to bridge that gap, to start to try things that might be out of my comfort zone? Because I want to grow as an adult sexually. I don't want to just be limited sexually, and I don't expect you to live with my limitations. Both of us are going to try things and stretch together. So an example of that might be many, many years ago, I had a client who, it was a couple, and she wanted him to be more romantic. And he came from kind of a, I would say, sort of a more blue-collar family that, you know, had a hard work ethic and they didn't have much luxury and quote romance in their life per se. And he said, you know, if you think I'm going to light candles and draw a bubble bath for you, you can forget it. I'm not that guy. And I said to him, well, if you're not going to do that, you're probably not going to get laid. Right? Because True. She was saying that she needed more romance and she wasn't asking for a lot. Mm-hmm. And so he had to really take himself on and challenge himself to do something that made him feel awkward, that really bumped up against his definition of masculinity. Because what did that say about him? And I reminded him, nobody would know about this, but the two of them. And that, you know, he was willing to give it a try, and it made a big difference for her in terms of her attraction to him, because she needed to feel desired, wanted. And this is very common for women when we're talking about heterosexual couples here. And so, and he liked sex that was a little bit more gruff, and we could just call it rough sex. It wasn't really BDSM. And she was willing to do that, but she had to feel safe and cared for and wanted first. So these are paradoxes that are inherent in all marriages, in all dynamics. And I think they're there because they force us to grow sexually. So when we're past the ages really of 20s and mid 30s, sex is not just about a drive anymore. It's really about, are we going to challenge ourselves and kind of grow up and define a sexuality that's an adult sexuality, not just keep doing what we were doing in our 20s and our 40s and wondering why it's not working.
Absolutely. And I think one other thing related to having kind of talking about these values, when people are in kind of recovery from sexual compulsivity, is that it helps people, gives them this framework for the couple to feel kind of explore and be playful. Because I would imagine if someone is trying to reintegrate kind of some of the acts that they used to do, and the partner might get very worried and kind of get alert, what if we're going through the same path? And I think having this framework, this kind of conversation, would provide some kind of comfort and help couples to be kind of playful and mindful within the framework that they're comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because, you know, the partners, the people who have been betrayed, whether it's been a single incident affair or, you know, sexual addiction and compulsivity, are always worried about whether they're going to be activating the other person, or that person's going to be thinking about their affair partner or the sex workers they hired. And it's very painful for them. And they end up foreclosing on themselves and giving away their sexuality. I mean, many women report that they used to love sex and really enjoy the freedom of sexuality, but now it felt shut down and not playful. And that's why, you know, explicit conversations, not about what the person who did the, you know, betraying did with other people, that's really irrelevant. It's more about, as a couple, what are we going to do together? And what do these sexual acts mean? How does it make me feel? And what are you thinking about when you're doing this? Are you thinking about me, or are you thinking about somebody else? And one of the things that's important to highlight here is that when people are really qualify as sex addicts, and we do have diagnostic criteria for that, that is pretty tried and true, they are typically moderately to severely dissociated. And that dissociation comes from early childhood trauma. So when they're having sex, they're really checked out. They're in a different zone altogether, and their partners can feel it. They can feel when the person is not present, they're not thinking about them, they're not making eye contact. And that's when trouble starts to happen in the sexual experience. So the more present both parties can be, the more honest they can be about what happens to them during sex, whether they go into shame or they get scared, the more intimate the sexual act becomes. And people might have to go through this sort of awkward period that doesn't feel that erotic or hot in order to get to those places, because they will deepen their love and their connection along the way.
And I think that certainly is a challenging task, because I work with clients for years and years. They learn to dissociate during sex. And right. If they're anchored in the moment, it's really hard for them to experience arousal.
Right. And so that's the challenge, is to become associated, not dissociated. And associated with your partner by making eye contact with them, talking to them, noticing what you're thinking about, what's happening between the two of you, the sights and smells of that person, as opposed to being in fantasy about previous acting out partners.
The other thought that I have was, like, I love this work, and I think it's just such a rich work of helping people figure out their sexual health plan after recovery. But I'm kind of curious, and again, I know it depends on people's history, but how soon people can transition to this kind of work when they enter the recovery kind of treatment?
Well, you know, it's different for everybody because like you said, it's more like eating. It's not something that you just stop like alcohol and you just never pick it up again. I mean, in some ways that's easier. Not that it's easy to get sober from drugs and alcohol, but you cannot have alcohol in your house. You can avoid it, but you can't avoid your sexuality and your partner. I mean, you can, but you'll be miserable in a different way.
Right.
So usually the trajectory is that the person has done a lot of work on themselves and really have arrested the behaviors they considered problematic, are looking at all the things that really activate them into wanting to act out, are becoming congruent with their own integrity, and are motivated to do what's true for them. And if they're in a relationship, the partner has also gone through a process, and perhaps they've gone through a process of what we call a formal disclosure, where the person who has done the betraying has written out a sexual timeline history and talked about the depth and breadth of their behaviors and their addiction, really, and how it's impacted the relationship. So the couple have to do a lot of repair work first before they can start to wade into kind of the more delicious and playful parts of sexuality. In my book, Erotic Intelligence, which came out in 2010, which is now on Audible, by the way.
Oh.
You can listen to it. That book is sort of a precursor to the workbook, Sexual Reflections, because it kind of gives people the landscape of where you start with just simple, healthy sex. And what does that mean other than, you know, just being able to make contact with each other before you move into more intimate, erotic, and spiritual realms? So I would direct people to that book first if they're in early recovery.
And I think one thing that's very important is just for people to continue their path in the journey of recovery. Because sometimes what I notice is people coming in when there's a crisis, and then after when the crisis passes and they kind of quote unquote sober, they kind of discontinue the treatment, which is very unfortunate. Because
yeah.
I feel they miss out at the best part of kind of like rediscovering their sexuality and just increases their chances of relapse.
You know, human beings are funny that way, right? We don't move necessarily towards what's good for us. We move away from what's painful. So, you know, if you're having heart problems, your doctor says you need to start eating well and exercising. But if you're eating well and exercising, you won't see your doctor for heart problems usually. So, you know, Dr. Carnes talks about this too. He says people get better enough. And they spend the bulk of their resources, their time, energy, and money on the front end by going to, you know, treatment programs because they're in crisis and they really need to stop doing what they're doing and their families are in upheaval. And they don't understand that really it's the long haul that makes the difference because you're moving out of the crisis stage and really out of just doing straight cognitive behavioral therapy, which is what the addiction model is, into deeper psychodynamic work and looking at your sexuality and making sexual health plans and restoring your relationship. So it is unfortunate that people see this as a sprint instead of a marathon.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I want to make sure before we're closing, we're touching on another thing that I felt it was really helpful that I witnessed you when you were doing it and that you were teaching about it in the class. And you talk about it in the book about tracking. And I know some of our listeners, they are therapists. And I know you talk about using a bodily based transference and count transferences with your clients. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think, you know, because we recognize now that the mind and the body and the brain are one organism, that we cannot separate the two. And in fact, Dan Siegel reminds us constantly that the brain is a social organ and that our mind exists in relationship to other people. So people can drive us out of our minds or help us, you know, reach our full potential. And certainly torture is an example of being driven mad because the nervous system cannot take the assault on it. And so, you know, the higher cortex dissociates, disconnects really from the limbic system in the body, and you get this deadness in the body. And of course, many clients, you know, grow up in abusive families are going to revert to that strategy non-consciously. It's just the way the body takes care of itself. And our job is to help people rekindle those circuits so they become more integrated and more whole. And so as a therapist, and that's the unique thing about sexual reflections, is that it's a workbook that's not just a cognitive workbook, but it has very interesting artistic images in it for people to color. And these were illustrated by Dr. Terry Marks Tarlow, who's an expert in nonlinear dynamic theory and fractals. And you'll see that these images have fractal natures to them because we're trying to evoke material from the right brain and the body. Likewise, during the process of going through the answers in the workbook, there's a therapist tracking guide in the back that asks the therapist to start to track, you know, what the client is noticing in his or her body as they're talking about these sexual acts. Is it evoking shame? Are they getting hyper aroused? Are they starting to dissociate? And what is the therapist feeling in his or her own body? What are they noticing as these conversations are ensuing? Because that's the intersubjective field. And something is emerging between the two parties that will be very useful in locating, quote, the truth. So the truth is emergent from what's true in the body, not just an idea of what I think I'd like to do. Because most addicts' idea of what they want to do are the things they were doing in their addiction. Mm-hmm. But if you ask somebody, oh, so you think having sex with a Martian is a good idea, what are you noticing in your body as you're saying that right now? Because you used to have sex with Martians all the time in your addiction. And that person will generally say, well, you know, I'm starting to notice that I'm getting this like high level of arousal, like maybe my heart is beating and my palms are sweating. And this is used to what I used to feel like when I was acting out. Mm-hmm. And then the therapist might say, yeah, based on what I know about your history, and I was getting a little bit of a tightness in my chest when you said that, because I worry that's really a slippery slope for you. Maybe we should take sex with Martians and put that on your watch and wait list, which is also in the workbook. And we'll come back to that. But right now, that feels like something that might derail your sexuality instead of helping you move towards a more integrated sexuality. And what do you think about that? So together, the therapist and client are making a decision based on what they're noticing, what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what they know based on history might be appropriate for this person.
And I really like that, the idea of naming what you're feeling as a therapist in your body and right. kind of and modeling it, and gives so much great information. Again, I always been kind of hesitant to do that, but like recently after your class, it was very helpful kind of like naming it and seeing that it can help the client go deeper on the conversation and them kind of give them encouragement and kind of power to kind of tune in and what's going on with their bodies as well.
Right. I mean, most people don't even know they have impulses in their bodies. And that kind of affective disclosure is so much more powerful, really, than cognitive disclosure, which can be nice for joining. Like, oh, you went to that college. I went to college on the East Coast too. Okay. But really, you know, again, Dan Siegel talks about the client feeling felt by the therapist, which is a very high level of attunement. Alan Shore, of course, talks about this in depth as well. So this notion that, wow, I'm feeling something as you're talking, that's a very intimate experience. And we're not just talking about intimacy, we're modeling it. I'm with you. I'm feeling with you through this. Wow, this is what I'm feeling. What are you feeling? Isn't that interesting? It's not right or wrong. It's just that I'm a human being here, and I'm so closely engaged with you that our nervous systems, our brain stems, the autonomic nervous system are all in concert with each other. And there is a nonverbal communication taking place that's extremely valuable.
Alex, I can talk about this for hours with you because you have so much great information and so many books and writing. And again, just it's wonderful to have you on the show. And I want to make sure that people know where to go if they want to get your book, where they can find your writing. I know you have a number of different kind of educational materials. So what would be the best way of getting access to those information?
Well, I would direct people to our website, which is centerforhealthysex.com. And there you'll find all of our webinars and CEU courses. We do a monthly CEU course for psychologists, marriage, family therapists, and that sort of thing. So you get one credit and it's free every month. And we have all manner of people coming and talking about all different aspects of sex and sexuality. We also have a YouTube channel that has probably well over 100 videos from sex experts around the country talking about every issue under the sun about sex and sexuality. So our website is a tremendous resource. If you want to take a look at my books, you can go to Amazon.com and type in my last name, KateHakis. And there you'll find all of my books on sex and sexuality.
Awesome. I make sure I leave a link in the show notes to all of those resources. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alexandra. At the end, I wanted to invite you guys to give me feedback on how I can improve this show about the topics you guys are interested to learn more about. I included a link in the show notes. It's a brief survey. It's like 4 questions. And if you take a moment and share with me that what are the topics you're interested in and how can I improve this podcast, I would truly appreciate it. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.